United States versus Green, 17-6001. Assessor?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Meredith Esser. I'm arguing this case on behalf of Marconia Green. This case presents the narrow question of whether there is a jurisdictional bar against courts considering second motions for reconsideration of sentence under Section 3582C2. The answer, as every circuit to have considered this question has held, is no. Any bar, if there is one, is non-jurisdictional in nature, and the government has waived any non-jurisdictional bar in this case.
And then we still have to decide whether he was entitled to get the modification, right? I mean, then there's the merits determination. Even if there isn't a jurisdictional bar, we have to decide whether the court erred, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, you said the only issue. There are two issues, right?
Yes. So
okay.
The discrete issue that the government raised in this case is the jurisdictional question. And if this court rules against the government on the jurisdictional question, then this court has to decide whether the case should be remanded to the district court.
Why aren't we bound by McGahee on that jurisdictional question?
McGahee, Your Honor? I'm not familiar with that case.
Okay. Don't we have several cases that hold that 3582 is a jurisdictional provision? Or are you suggesting it's an open issue
there
in
the
circuit?
The two cases that I'm familiar with are Randall and Randall is the case that I think is the closest case here, but Randall doesn't say anything about jurisdiction. Randall is the case about a motion for reconsideration of a 3582 motion, and under Randall, this court has said that there is a defendant cannot make a motion for reconsideration outside of the 14-day time limit for appeal, but this court didn't say anything about whether that bar was jurisdictional in nature.
Why would we have to remand? I'm not following you on that. Why would we have to remand if the government loses on the jurisdictional question? Isn't it then appropriate for us to just go to the merits and say, did the court err in denying on the merits this successive 3582?
Your Honor, we're asking for remand because Mr. Green raised some additional facts in his pro se opening brief that were not considered.
Yes,
by
the disciplinary record.
Yes, which, as this court is aware, that's a very considerable achievement on his part, that he has a completely clear conduct disciplinary record in prison, and the district court was not aware of that particular fact.
So he wasn't aware of it because Mr. Green didn't bring it to the court's attention, right?
That's correct. But as you know, Mr. Green filed his opening brief pro se, and we would ask that this court liberally construe those factual statements that he made in his opening brief and allow the district court to consider this new information that goes right to the heart of what the district court was concerned with at sentencing, which was the fact that Mr. Green had a long criminal history, and the district court was concerned with Mr. Green's potential for recidivism.
Wasn't the district court also concerned with Mr. Green's tendency to manipulate the system? He attempted to claim to be incompetent. This is the same district court that called him you are a malingerer, you are a recidivist crack dealer, and I think that's the gist of it. Why would we think that court is going to do anything different when they hear about his disciplinary record and his achievement of not having a disciplinary problem?
Because I think it really strikes the heart of what the court was concerned with, which was recidivism.
Wasn't it concerned with remorse, failure to have remorse, and manipulating the system? The court also noted the malinger, and the malinger, right, references back to when Green was trying to claim that he was incompetent, right?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think there was some discussion in the record about whether that was a deliberate strategy on the part of a prior trial counsel to attempt to get some sort of a defense that Mr. Green himself may not have agreed with. So there, he had two counsel.
Well, the court thought he did it, right? They called
right.
him a court
Absolutely.
Called him a malingerer.
The court did call him a malingerer. But I think that the fact that he had zero disciplinary infractions in prison would also go to that point. I mean, there are a myriad ways that you could get a disciplinary infraction in prison.
Well, counsel, let me. I can't speak for the rest of the court, but you've gone a bridge too far for me in regards to the first issue is what Judge Holmes was talking about is a question of jurisdiction or a claims processing under our case law and particularly under a recent Supreme Court case where I think that Justice Ginsburg makes a complete distinction between jurisdiction that might apply here and also claims processing, which the government did not raise, by the way. The question in my mind is when is this over under the basis of what you're arguing? So if we say we have jurisdiction, that entitles us to go to the merits that we have before us. And we don't have a lot of the things that you're arguing for as far as a remand before us, do we?
In terms of his disciplinary record?
Yes.
That's correct. It was not presented at the district court.
So it appears to me, as far as I'm concerned, if we have jurisdiction, that entitles us to get to the merits, as you've raised in regards to this, as to whether he wins or loses in regards to that. The next question is that you're arguing, unless there's been a claims process, once we determine that we have jurisdiction, when are these type of claims over? It would appear to me that you can just keep bringing them again and again until the proper issue is raised by the government as far as timeliness, and it is over finally. So that's just where I am in regards to this. So it seems to me that you might really be happy with, yeah, you have jurisdiction, court, and please go to the merits of what I've raised. Right?
Yes.
All right.
So in terms of your concern about whether a defendant could just file an unlimited number of these, I don't think that there's any bar against that. I don't think that the plain language of the statute bars any second or subsequent.
But claims motion. Processing might bar it.
Correct.
Well,
I don't
right.
think that the jurisdictional question would. I don't think there's a lack of jurisdiction.
I don't either, just to be frank with you. And I'm just saying that for the government's benefit right now. But I do have a question. And they have not raised claim processing. So that's just free information, Kyle.
I think in terms of the claims processing rule, if this court were to read one into this case, it would be up to the government to raise it. And I think that there could be some equitable situations where the government would not want to raise such a defense at the district court level. And that's why it's a question of jurisdiction and not one of claims processing.
Let me ask a question relative to the merits, excising out for the moment the question of the disciplinary record. The merits as they stand now, as presented to the district court. In evaluating whether the district court erred in doing that, why should we not give some law of the case of effect to our endorsement of the district court's rationale in the prior appeal of its denial of the 3582C. In that prior appeal in Green, we specifically looked at in the factors that the court considered at the time and found, I could pull out the language, but it was something along the lines of justified its determination. Well, if we did that before, why now when we're looking at that limited record that we have before us, why don't we say, well, we've got law of the case there. We've got us endorsing that exact analysis on the exact record which is before us now, and the district court here relied upon its prior determinations in reaching its conclusion. So help me. Why not?
Well, first of all, the government hasn't raised the law of the case argument.
I'm asking you.
And second of all, I don't disagree with you that the records are very similar. Mr. Green did append some additional certifications that he had received while he was in prison. So there are changed circumstances. I don't think it's a completely on the face of it law of the case doctrine type situation because there were some additional courses that he had completed between the filing of the first motion and 2 years later the filing of the second motion.
True, but and I take your point that the government didn't raise this, but it seems to me that the universe of the court specifically said, the district court here says, these additional things don't change what I did before. Okay, so you got what you did before that we've said is justified. Court specifically says these additional things that you're presented don't change that. So it seems to me, by logically, the only thing if we were applying law of the case, the only thing we would be reviewing is the court's determination that these things don't change what I did before.
Your Honor, I think that my position has to be that the law of the case doctrine, it's not on all fours because there are some changed circumstances here. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the rest
thank
of my time.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank
Let's hear from the government.
May it please the Court, Stephen Kreger on behalf of the United States. And I understand that I have a difficult row to hoe in order to address the jurisdictional issue. But I think there are three
questions.
Were
you counsel below?
I was counsel on the 3582 issue in the first instance. There was no response requested in this 3582 motion.
And you acknowledge you didn't raise here before us a claims processing issue?
No, Your Honor.
All right. So it's strictly question of whether we have the jurisdiction is your argument.
Correct. The first question is jurisdiction. If the court concludes there's jurisdiction, it goes to the merits and the right. question of abuse of discretion. Yeah. There are three questions that are essentially dispositive of the jurisdictional issue in this case. These three questions are answered by this court's precedent and the text as well as Supreme Court precedent. And these questions are questions that the other circuits to address this issue either have not addressed or have implicitly, the government would submit, decided wrongly. The first question is whether 3582C is a jurisdictional statute. As Judge Timkovich pointed out, this court and McGahee and Spalding has said that 3582 is a clear and mandatory restriction on the court's jurisdiction. That's because the language of the statute says a court may not modify a term of imprisonment once imposed. There's additional language which I will get to in just a moment.
But it looks like McGahee's a bit of an outlier now, isn't it, given
it might be
subsequent treatment by other circuits and the Supreme Court's decision in the Hammer that I think Judge Baalbek was referring to?
It might be an outlier amongst the circuits, but this court in McGahee applied Supreme Court precedents, things like Thaler, which say jurisdictional rules go to the court's adjudicatory power. These are rules, and this was a rule enacted by Congress, and it's a rule that has a historical foundation at common law. As the Supreme Court recognized in cases like Mayer and Murray, at common law, the court, once it imposed the sentence, and once the defendant either started executing the sentence or the term of court expired, didn't have jurisdiction to modify the sentence. It wasn't until Rule 35 permitted a 120-day time limit to modify a sentence that that jurisdictional limitation essentially went away. This was back in the time when
So is your position that we're bound by those, by McGahee at all?
Yes, Your Honor.
Spalding?
Yes, Your Honor. This court has not overruled or held that either of those cases are abrogated. And again, it relied on the plain text. It relied on Supreme Court precedent discussing what is the jurisdictional rule. And it discussed going to the heart of the court's authority to modify it.
Have you read Hammer that just came out in regard that Justice Ginsburg wrote?
I have skimmed it. I haven't read it thoroughly.
Okay. So you're not familiar with the detailed explanation that the court goes into, the difference between when the court has jurisdiction and when claims processing applies then.
My understanding from the read that I did, it was not an in-depth read, was that, if I'm not mistaken, Hammer has to do with extensions of time to file a notice of appeal for purposes of civil appeals.
But it does, well.
Hammer says that rules are not jurisdictional, and that directly contradicts what McGahee held regarding Rule 35.
Right. As far as whether Rule 35 is jurisdictional, that might have been abrogated. But the portion of McGahee that talks about 3582C, which is not a rule but is a statute Congress enacted, goes to the jurisdiction of the court.
But there's nothing in the terms of 3582 that speaks about successive motions. So, I mean, why would calling it jurisdictional be dispositive of anything?
And, Your Honor, that goes to the second and third question.
Good.
The second question is 3582C an exception to the general rule? So assuming that it's jurisdictional, as this court held in McGahee, is 3582C to an exception, which the language says yes, because right after it says the court may not modify a term of imprisonment once imposed, except that.
And if it is an exception, that creates a big question mark. So what? It means you construe it narrowly, right? So.
Correct. And so if it's an exception that you construe narrowly, which this court's case law says that you construe exceptions narrowly, then where Congress is silent, you look back to the default rule. You look back to the general principle. Because otherwise, if you don't, then you have this, what the Seventh Circuit described in Red, such an interpretation would strike at the heart of the determinate sentencing scheme. It would leave open forever the district court's ability to continually modify its sentence.
No, it wouldn't. You didn't raise any claims processing arguments here. There could be procedural arguments that could be made. You didn't make them. So, no, it doesn't mean we're opening the floodgates to a succession of 3582 motions at all. Does it? Why?
There would have to be some sort of implicit. There are no specific limitations, be they claims processing rules or jurisdictional limits, other than to go back and say 3582C. Now, if this court was to announce one, then yes.
You can argue one just because some sort of equitable jurisdictional limit or the argument that there's supposed to be, if it is an exception, let's assume it is an exception. That means it's narrowly construed. That will then one could infer congressional intent to say that we don't want repeated 3582 motions, right?
Correct. And if that is...
That's not an argument you made, right?
If that is the inference, that Congress did not want successive 3582 motions, C2 motions, then that's because the default rule that Congress established in 3582C, which is a jurisdictional rule, governs, at which point there is a lack of jurisdiction.
That rule says nothing about successive motions. The statute says nothing about successive motions. So why would characterizing the statute as jurisdictional answer the question?
Because the thing that does not say anything about it is the exception. So if you construe the exception narrowly, then what is not included in the exception defaults to the general rule.
Construing it narrowly doesn't mean that we read words into anything, does it?
No. Yeah.
All right, word successive motions is nowhere in there and we're not reading it in, right?
If this court were to say that there is jurisdiction, if the court says that there is no jurisdiction at 3582C and that 3582C2 is a narrow exception, then in order to say that a successive motion under 3582C2 is permissible under 3582C, the court would necessarily have to read the words and successive motions may move successively into C2 in order to broaden the exception. So the argument...
Well, counsel, evidently, if your jurisdictional argument fails, how do you propose, I guess you assume that it's all right for them just to keep filing over and over and over and coming back in. What we want to know is when are we going to finish hearing all of these in absence of a claims processing rule? So it's all right with you if they just keep bringing them over and over and over again?
No, Your Honor. And
now, how are you going to stop it?
I will admit that the government didn't raise in this case and this court should not.
Well, how do you propose if this court says we have jurisdiction, how do you propose to stop the refiling of these over and over if it's successive?
Your Honor, I would suggest this court could either do what the Seventh Circuit did in Beard, which is simply say, while it's not jurisdictional, there are claims processing rules that the court can raise sua sponte, or could do what the Fourth Circuit did in May, which is say there is jurisdiction, but for future reference, to provide guidance to counsel and to the court, there are these claims processing rules, and this court could latch on to Randall, which was based on the Fourth Circuit Goodwin decision, and say 14 days is your limit.
And of all those, which do you prefer?
I would suggest that this court should say Randall and say the 14 days in Randall is the – there is no difference between successive motions and motions for reconsideration, and any new motion would need to be filed within 14 days. Otherwise, it's barred.
But these are proposals you've never made in writing anywhere?
Not in this case, no.
Okay. So that proposal really, at least – although our waiver rules are discretionary, you've waived this, right?
Yes, sir. All
right.
So this one, if we say we have jurisdiction, we're going to the merits, right?
Yes, sir.
All right.
And I'm happy to discuss the merits. This court has already reviewed, in large part, the district court's decision in the past Green appeal and concluded the district court did not abuse its discretion. As Judge Fried explained in his order denying Mr. Green's current motion, nothing really has changed. Yes, he's had a few more classes, but nothing affects the fact that he's appeared 17 times in front of 17 different judges asking for leniency. The fact that, as Judge Bryant put it, he was a killer, a malingerer, and a recidivist crack dealer. The fact that he already received, on the front end, a very good deal from the government. Had he been convicted of the charges that he was originally charged with, he would have been a career offender and faced 188 to 235 months imprisonment. But instead, he was capped out and he only received 130 months sentence. And so not only had he gone to trial and had he not entered into the plea agreement with the government, he wouldn't have been eligible as a career offender for relief under 782, and he would have been stuck at 188 months if the district court had imposed the guideline sentence in that instance, the low-end guideline sentence. I would have been facing something even greater than that if the court had gone to the top of the guidelines or above the guidelines. I'm happy to answer any other questions the court might have.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You cede your time. Ms. Esser, you had some rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I briefly familiarized myself with the McGahee case, and I think it's distinguishable because that case did not involve a 3582C2 motion. It involved a 2255 motion that was granted, and then a motion to reconsider after the grant of a 2255. And I think that the circumstance in McGahee really dovetails well with the 11th Circuit's decision in Caraballo, which discusses several different circumstances when a second or a motion for reconsideration on a 3582 motion comes up. So in that case, the court distinguished a grant of a 3582 motion from a denial on the merits and a procedural denial, and said that when a defendant files for a motion for reconsideration after a grant of the motion, the grant constitutes a resentencing. So then the Rule 35 kicks in. So in that way, McGahee would be like the situation where there was a grant of a resentencing, Rule 35 then kicks in, and perhaps in that circumstance, any bar to a motion for reconsideration would become jurisdictional in nature, but that's not the situation that we have in this case. This case was a second motion. It was not a motion for reconsideration, and it was also a case in which there was no grant of the first motion. So it's distinguishable from McGahee and from the circumstance that was discussed in Caraballo. If the court has no further questions, I would ask that the court remand to the district court for consideration of the new information that was presented by Mr. Green's pro se brief.
Well done, counsel.
Thank you.
Okay, that case is submitted. The counselor excused.